As of this moment, we are all dead. We go into battle to reclaim our lives. This we do gladly, for we are Jim'Hadar. Remember, victory is life.
Victory is life.
Space, the final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast Gimme That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
Welcome to episode 57 of Gimme That Star Trek, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Siskoid, and today we offer one of those alien race spotlights we occasionally do. We've done the Borg, the Cardassians, plot twist, the Bolians. So who's next? Well, today I've invited my friend Ryan Blake back to the show and asked him to gimme those Jem'Hadar. Hi, Ryan.
Hello, podcasting is life.
This is a race that we've been talking about doing a spotlight on for a good while, I think, because there are some interesting ramifications to their existence.
Yeah, certainly since the Borg episode, whenever that was, many, many moons ago.
Right, that was like one of the first ones that we did. The Jem'Hadar. So people who don't know, this is a race that was introduced in Deep Space Nine. You know, genetically engineered soldiers of the Dominion, basically. I just had a little note on the origin of the name, Jem'Hadar. Like, where does that come from? The creators found it in a thesaurus. They looked under soldier and they found Jem'Hadar. It is a rank in the Indian Army, which is interesting to me because the Dominion has always seemed vaguely Eastern. It's like Middle East, India, just like the fashions and then the jihad that they're having. And in the grand political illusion of Star Trek, I always felt like the Dominion or the Gamma Quadrant basically was supposed to be Asia in some way. I don't know if you had that same impression.
Oh, that's interesting because I always saw them as a combination of the British Empire and the Persian Empire. The Jem'Hadar, interestingly, it's not just soldier, but it's the lowest rank you can get for a viceroy's junior commissioned officer under the British Raj. So it's a name that only exists because of imperial occupation. And also, I found out that it also means a person who sweeps homes or offices as a job. It's a very menial position. But the reason I think of them as a combination of those two empires, the British and the Persian, is one is obviously the nature of occupation and the way they take control of planets by saying, we're going to bring you civilization and all the benefits of the Dominion. We're going to give you new technology. I don't know what the equivalent of cricket is in the Dominion, but, you know, that kind of thing, the whole bread and circuses thing. And also simply because, I say, the Persian Empire is a bit misleading, but when you get into the nitty-gritty of the Jem'Hadar, there is a very strong overtone, I felt, of a religious fanatic suicide troop, because they are all martyrs to a religious cause, because the Dominion is weirdly a kind of, and only Star Trek could really do this, a scientific theocracy, because the founders are gods in their eyes, and they are absolutely willing to die for them. So they're an odd combination of this colonialism and this religious fanaticism. I mean, obviously, we're not talking about the Vorta per se, but you can't talk about the Jem'Hadar without at least mentioning the Vorta, because they're critical to who the Jem'Hadar are as an identity. But you've got people who blindly follow this pantheon of gods, if you like, and are willing to do anything for them. And, you know, obedience brings victory. Victory is life. I mean, that's the war cry of a fanatic. That's someone who will strap a bomb to themselves and run into a crowd of the enemy because God has told them to. Right. So that's how I saw them.
And you see how I kind of link that to fundamentalist Islamists. And I'm trying to be in the head as well of the writers. Were they looking at the Persian Empire or were they looking more at the sociopolitical world as it is today, just like in the 60s? The Klingons and Romulans are obviously supposed to be elements of the Cold War because that's what they were living through. I don't think Star Trek was doing it on purpose necessarily by the time of DS9, but I can't help but try to think of the entire galaxy as the writer's interpretation of our world that we live in. Regardless of where the Jem'Hadar come from or the Dominion comes from, I think you can totally make that claim that they are 19th century colonialism, essentially. You know, the Jem'Hadar are this one specific part of it, which is the soldier class. And if we talk about just their biology, we know that they were hatched and force grown. It takes about 3 days for them to reach maturity. They only have males, no procreation. They are born with the warrior skills and that devotion to the founders that you talked about. I guess the question biologically is, were these guys, you know, did they have a people, a culture before the Dominion found them? Or were they animals that were jumped up like the Vorta were? Like the Vorta were apparently like these little, I don't know, monkeys or marmosets or squirrels or something. And then they became the basis for this clone race. What about the Jem'Hadar? Because that's never said. So I wonder what your opinion was on that.
It's interesting because there's never, we get this sort of, it's not apocryphal. Well, it's canon, as in it's in an episode, but it's the apocryphal origin of the Vorta.
Right.
And the Jem'Hadar, I always thought the Jem'Hadar were like a kind of Komodo dragon, you know, reptilian land shark kind of a creature that they evolved up slightly and gave them basic language skills and what have you. Because what's really strange is whatever they did to the Jem'Hadar, let's assume the Jem'Hadar are for a moment pre-existing and they've altered them. A lot of their biology, it's very strange. Why create a species or why evolve a species and give them one gender? Because they do specifically say they are all male. Why give them a gender when they can't procreate? And if you're going to make them from scratch and hatch them after 3 days and all that, that I get because you're making a warrior race. But they initially come out and they need to eat and drink and then they don't. And that's a very strange way of constructing something when you're going to addict someone to the drug, the Ketchusel White and all that stuff. There's lots of stuff about them that's very, very strange in the way they've done it, which makes me think it's kind of like junk DNA. You know, they've got all these parts that aren't really useful anymore. I mean, not to get, I know it's not that kind of podcast, but if they are all male, that means they have certain male parts. And because they are hyper aggressive, that must mean that they have certain chemicals going through their body as a rule.
Testosterone or whatnot.
Testosterone, et cetera, et cetera. But they've no way of venting it except through combat, which is not the same thing. So I figure they evolved them from another creature and just didn't bother to clean out, if that's the right expression, or to remove the irrelevant parts. Like they've got, the fact that they're male is a bit like their appendix. You know, the fact they're male is kind of irrelevant, but they didn't bother to take away all the male parts.
Mm-hmm. But because there is this other oddity to this whole thing is that they are made to be addicted to Ketchusel White. And then you think, well, if you're genetically engineering these guys and you're already giving them obedience as a mantra and something that is, you know, inborn, why do you also need to addict them to keep them under your thumb? What we see when we see Jem'Hadar get off the drug, few survive this, but those that do, or even while they're in, they're going through the withdrawal, they start attacking each other. You know, it's like they're so violent that the drug is sort of a pacifier in a way or a focuser, but without it, they can be rebellious. And it's like we've created this soldier race that could rebel unless we also addict them to a chemical. And I think the chemical, we never learn these origin stories, but my feeling is that, you know, they have this power to shroud.
Yes, the Dete, as it's called.
Yeah, so the Jem'Hadar can, they're like the Predators in those movies, you know, they can become invisible or camouflaged. But when they don't have the Ketchusel White, they can't do that anymore. So I'm almost thinking, you know, nobody can have that in their biology. So it's the chemical gives them this ability, but it is also addictive. You know, it has other side effects. So I'm thinking that you know, we'd never see like the prototypical Jem'Hadar. That would be a really cool, it's a bit like they're the Santarans if we compare this to Doctor Who. Like the audio stories, etc., have told us the stories of the first Santarans, so we can, because it's a time travel show. Star Trek is sometimes a time travel show. Too many times it's a time travel show. But also, and we never see, you know, obviously we're never going to find this out unless maybe it's in a novel or something. I find this interesting that maybe the Ketracel White, the addictive properties of it may have been a side effect. And now we're just like, that's just the normal now, you know. Obviously, no Jem'Hadar is going to remember the before times because, like, they die around, you know, 7 years old or something. That's like an old Jem'Hadar.
Here's the thing. Now this is one of the sort of issues with the Ketracel White. To start with, they were very clear that it's a drug and they're addicted to the drug, mm-hmm. and that's why they have to be loyal. Then they changed it so that apparently it was an addictive narcotic, but it also had something called an isogenic enzyme, which meant they were deliberately genetically extracting from their body the ability to create the enzyme. So they needed the Ketracel White to live, and also they didn't need food or drink because of it. So it's a very strange sort of melange of different chemical, sort of a range of chemical fulfillments it provides for their body. And like you said, they can't shroud without it and they go insane. But the thing is, and this is what makes them one of the many things that makes Jem'Hadar so tragic, there are occasional mutants who can produce it and things like that. The problem is for them, it's not like they can go cold turkey from the Ketracel White and tough it out. Their body cannot produce the chemical they need to survive. It's like, okay, so human beings need vitamin C in order to survive. We need a certain amount. Our bodies can't produce it ourselves. So we must consume vitamin C to live. It's not an issue of willpower. It's an issue of biology. So if we stop having vitamin C full stop, we die. You get like scurvy, which is takes a lot longer to kill you than going without Ketracel White, but it's the same. It's 100% fatal in all cases. So they're addicted to it, but I wonder, are they addicted? I'm trying to think how best to put this. They require it to live. So is the addiction psychosomatic in the sense of, if I don't get this, I die, and that translates in their head as an addiction? Or is it that there literally is something in it that gives them a bit of a kick, shall we say, when the Vorta gives it to them?
Mm, that's not clear either way, right?
No, it's really not.
Yeah, so I think maybe, well, it all depends. Okay, let's call it vitamin C, although our body cannot produce it, nor are there individuals who can produce it spontaneously.
Well, good point. Yeah, the analogy falls down a little bit.
But still, let's use that, right? If we are deficient, we may or may not crave oranges. You know, we may or may not. I don't know. So maybe cravings may or may not be things that are missing from your present state. Sometimes they are, but other times, you know, I'm not sure what's missing in you when you crave potato chips. But you may or may not crave oranges. But you would still go through what they call withdrawal on the show for the Ketracel White is really just scurvy. You know, the equivalent of scurvy.
Yeah.
And it obviously doesn't have the same potency and it doesn't have the same effects. But suddenly, you know, they're not feeling well. They feel sick. They feel more violent. They're edgier and they can't shroud. And so they know, you know, they know that something's up and that it's missing from their system. And so they want the Ketracel White. But would they be like heroin junkies? We don't see that necessarily. You know, we see the withdrawal, but we don't see the craving. So you may be right that it's just like whatever juice that we create in our bodies that is necessary, whatever it is. You know, there are many hormones or whatever that, you know, that you need. Well, it's more like diabetes or something.
Yeah.
Okay. So Ketracel White is insulin. We normally produce it, but let's say somebody took the human race and genetically modified it so that we did not produce insulin. Or pancreas, like remove the pancreas or something. And then you would need to take injections of insulin as a matter of course. And if you didn't have it, you'd die. That's kind of what they did to them. Now, I'm not sure we would crave insulin, but yeah. So maybe that's what my question really is. Why the extra step? If you're already bioengineering someone, a creature, to be totally devoted to this leadership, it's already got that. In its DNA, they feel compelled to live and die for the Dominion, for the Founders. Why also make them? I think this is why I think that maybe they were a people. Like, unlike like the Vorta, we took animals, we turned them, like these meek animals, we turned them into people that are also completely devoted to the Founders. But with the Jem'Hadar, we found this, like, primitive warrior race, savage race, animalistic race. They were on this planet somewhere. Whatever they found, they fought it. They tried to kill it, including themselves. This was not a species that was going to go very far. And then we took them. We like those traits. We like their full aggression. What if we can harness that? And let's give them the superpower of you know, shrouding. And you know, over time, that's the Jem'Hadar. But in reality, like, you know, like they force grow them and they didn't pick up any females. But maybe there's a planet out there with still some sort of proto Jem'Hadar females, if that planet still exists.
Yeah.
But the way it's more like, okay, we're going to take these people, we're going to enslave them, and we're going to turn them into our warrior race, and we're going to give them this false culture. And then they're in our service and we're growing them super fast. They become divorced from whatever they were before. But I'm not sure they were rhinoceroses or anything, you know?
Yeah, I think they were probably, like you said, a primitive low level of sentience. They were, you know, cave dwellers or something. Yeah.
Yeah, something that they recognized, that the founders recognized at some point, oh, they'd make great cannon fodder for us, you know, and then change them. But again, this is not particularly explored on the show.
What I find interesting is there's conspicuously a lack of origin story for the Jem'Hadar, whereas the Vorta from the episode Treachery, Faith and the Great River, it seems like the Vorta origin story is encouraged amongst the Vorta and spread deliberately as sort of quite, kind of like religious propaganda, because the Vorta was really happy to tell Odo that story of, oh, we were primitive, we didn't have anything, we just ate nuts in the trees, and then we hid a changeling, and then they said, one day I'll come back and raise you up, and now they're part of the Dominion. Mm-hmm. Now, how true that is, we don't know. And Odo questions it and says, why were the people chasing the changeling and all that stuff? So we're only told a little bit of the story. And obviously it's been handed down for thousands of years. But if you think about it, the changelings can tell the Vorta that story and encourage it because, okay, let's say there's a mass rebellion of the Vorta. Well, what are they going to achieve? Nothing much. They're good talkers, but they can't fight. If the Jem'Hadar ever get wind of their origin story, we've seen that the Jem'Hadar do question. And some Jem'Hadar do rebel. So imagine they find out what really happened with them at the beginning and whether they've been tinkered with or what have you. That would foment rebellion amongst a lot of them. Some of them, it would probably make them more loyal, but enough of them would rebel. And as we've been told, the founder's control over the Jem'Hadar is not as strong as we've been led to believe. So I think the lack of origin story is a very deliberate move by the founders and the people who run the Dominion to keep them ignorant. So they stay loyal and don't question, because if they knew too much about who they really were, rebellion.
Mm-hmm. There are many controls. There's a suspicious number of controls because, you know, they're genetically predisposed to be loyal to the Dominion. They've also got an addiction to Ketracel White, which is only handed down by the founders through the Vorta. They don't live long. Like, they don't have a normal growth of childhood and adolescence. And then they're dead by age 7 if they're lucky, if they're super lucky.
You know. Yeah, if they get to 13, they're considered honored elders.
Exactly.
13.
So you don't have a lot of time to transmit your culture, that story. Mm. Everything is made to be like they are cannon fodder. They're meant to die. And they don't have time to create much of a culture or hand down any information. By the time they're ready to rebel, they're dead. So there are a lot of controls for a creature that you supposedly created out of whole cloth. You know, that's, and the other, it's a clue. It's more of a parenthesis. They seem to be cousins to the Tosk.
Yes.
You know, they look, yes, all look vaguely reptilian the same way. They have the same ability to shroud. And Tosk came from the Gamma Quadrant. Tosk was bred by someone to be prey. And then there's some like people having fun chasing him. And you know, that's what a Tosk is made for. It's a little bit like the reverse. The Jem'Hadar are bred to be predators. And then this other subspecies, possibly created by the founders as well, is just meant to be prey for the fun of some other Gamma Quadrant species.
There is a beta canon explanation of the similarities between Tosk and Jem'Hadar. In the role-playing game, they write a very specific connection that the Tosk are more or less made of the same stuff as the Jem'Hadar, and they were given to that species as a kind of welcome to the Dominion gift. And they said, right, because they've got advanced technology and they're good fighters and they want them on the side of the Dominion, they said, right, you have this and you join the Dominion, you know, these are the benefits, and you give us your technology and blah, blah, blah. So they do directly, like I said, that's in the role-playing game, but it's a pretty neat explanation. And like you said, you picked up on it as well. And I think a lot of us were like, they're very similar, aren't they?
Yeah, it certainly fits. I'm sure the creators of the show had this in mind as well, because it's like they're laying in clues in early seasons. And then when we finally see the Dominion, they don't necessarily relate to that, because they're just not, you know, what would be the point in an episodic television show for 3 years later O'Brien says, oh, it's just like Tosk. And then you hope that people remember that character. You know, that just wasn't how they were allowed to make the show, especially in the early seasons. Whether it's in the minds of the writers, it's certainly in ours to say, well, all the clues of that we heard in that episode, they all do relate to the Dominion later on. You know, it makes sense. But it turns the Dominion as well into, like, they were fabricating people to have certain roles. But in the story you just told, it's also a slave trade. So it makes the Dominion even more sinister. Let's talk about Jem'Hadar's psychology. Like you said, they believe that the Founders are gods, totally loyal to them. They're loyal to the Vorta, but I think they resent the Vorta. They are consummate soldiers, but I called it a transplanted culture. No glory, no respect for life, even their own. But they still have a warrior's code. I'm thinking of like By Inferno's Light, where one refuses to kill Worf.
It's interesting you say that, because it seems like the Jem'Hadar don't have a single culture in some ways, but in other ways, obviously in other ways they do, you know, victory is life and what have you. But in some ways, it depends on their distance from the Founders. Let me explain that. The example you just cited is very, very interesting, because when he says, I can't defeat this Klingon, I can only kill him, and that no longer holds my interest. Right. And he gets killed for it. That is a Jem'Hadar who is in a remote outpost, presumably thousands, if not millions of light years from the Founders. We don't know if he's ever met a Founder. We can only speculate, but let's assume for this hypothesis that he hasn't.
Yeah, most have not. We're told that.
Absolutely. And so what has this Jem'Hadar been doing for a chunk of his military career? He has been facing multiple different alien cultures and fought them in one-to-one battles. So he has been exposed to the wider galaxy, and not as a conqueror, but as a jailer and someone who's been fighting them one-to-one. So he had directly seen different cultures and how they act in certain circumstances, in battle, certainly. And that Jem'Hadar has spontaneously or over time generated some kind of ethical code which differentiates him from most Jem'Hadar. Most Jem'Hadar will just kill you, kill you, kill you. That's it. But this Jem'Hadar learned to think for himself and thought, there has to be more. There has to be a reason for this killing. I can't beat this person. He has shown something, some strength. I don't know if a Jem'Hadar would use the word honor, but some kind of, you know, spirit, what have you, whatever you want to call it. I cannot beat that. And killing and beating someone are two separate things, which a lot of Jem'Hadar can't make that differentiation because they just blindly follow orders. And he had somehow come up with this idea, this premise that killing this person won't beat them. And I don't want to kill them because I can't beat them. And so he generated a kind of rudimentary sort of, like you said, an honor code of some kind. And he's instantly killed by a Jem'Hadar, but the Vorta instantly said, kill them both. There was no hesitation, and there was a look of disgust on the Vorta. If I'm going to be completely honest, I don't know how much they were thinking about this. I think it might have been a little bit more interesting if the Vorta had a look of fear on their face rather than disgust. Maybe he was just being super professional, I don't know. But the moment that Jem'Hadar learned to think for themselves, and remember, that Jem'Hadar was not saying down with the Founders. He was not saying, oh, maybe these Federation people aren't so bad. He just said, I don't want to kill this person because I can't beat them. The most rudimentary, nascent sort of pupae of a code of honor that was not just victory is life. He was saying, I can't achieve victory by taking this person's life. And instantly the Vorta said, kill him. Okay. And that guy, I don't know how much you could tell from the makeup, but from the way that Jem'Hadar conducted themselves, I assumed they'd been doing it for a few years. You know, they were quite experienced. So I found that scene. That scene's one of the most interesting scenes for Jem'Hadar psychology, because going on to like Hippocratic Oath, where we have the Jem'Hadar, is it Tarantar? I'm terrible with Jem'Hadar names, or Garanagar or whatever, but one of those guys. He, like you said earlier, he made the point of saying, we never see our gods. That Jem'Hadar was sort of on the verge of almost being like a Jem'Hadar atheist, if you like, or at least, if not an atheist, then certainly like agnostic, or someone who was exposed to the Greek gods and thought these gods aren't worth worshipping, and was trying to lead his people. He was almost like a Jem'Hadar Moses, trying to lead his people out of that. Actually, I suppose Moses is the wrong analogy. He was trying to get away from their oppression anyway. And so we see that the further the Jem'Hadar get from the Founders, the more likely it seems they're likely to think for themselves and develop rudimentary codes and a different psychological structure.
Well, we do see that, because there is, even absent a culture, the Jem'Hadar that are grown in the Alpha Quadrant, as the war goes on and the wormhole is blockaded, they start making Jem'Hadar in the Alpha Quadrant. And the Alphas and the Gammas, don't get along. They don't have the same exact culture. There is a clash between them. There's a confrontational attitude between them. That goes with your thesis. You know, because like they don't do the ritual, the I am such and such and I am dead. They just take the Ketrasol White and plug it in. They don't do the little speech.
Because they had a philosophy of our actions display our loyalty rather than the words.
Right. So there is a shift in culture, if we can call it that, because of distance. Because the Alpha Ones, even though there's Founders in the Alpha Quadrant, there's Vorta in the Alpha Quadrant, they still sort of create their own subgroup. Again, if the Jem'Hadar are real, by which I mean if they pre-existed and were simply modified, they probably were quite tribal. And we see in the Gammas and the Alphas a tribalism spring up.
Instantly as well.
Instinctively. We Alphas are better than you Gammas, where technically you should all be the same. But, you know, like maybe there's some like coding in there for them to fight Alpha Quadrant species. And if they were to go to the Gamma Quadrant, maybe their skills would be kind of off. But in the Alpha Quadrant, they believe anyways that they are the better fighters than Gammas who have been programmed with the wrong reflexes. That may be it. But like they see the difference and they act on it. So it's like watching children create their own culture in a way, a reflexive culture.
Yeah, I likened it to Protestants and Catholics in the sense that they both worship the same thing, but they do it differently and argue about it because it's, you know, it's somewhat theocratic in the way that they do it. I did wonder, and I wondered if you had any theories on this. One, do we ever see any of the Alpha Shroud? Because I can't remember seeing an Alpha Shroud at all. I'm sure they must have done, and I've just probably not seen it or not recognized them as an Alpha. But I don't remember ever seeing an Alpha Shroud.
I'm pretty sure they can, or else it would have been... Somebody would have said something. It's just, I think, yeah, I think by the time we're seeing Alphas, by that point, we're deep in the Dominion War, and it's really about fighting hand-to-hand with these guys in corridors. So they don't do the Predator thing, which would be an effect that they'd have to pay for, and...
Yeah.
And at that point, we know they can do this, and maybe the storylines aren't. We don't get a lot of Jem'Hadar specific storylines in the back end.
I do wonder if there's a reason in universe for making the Alphas look different, because I'm wondering, we don't know how far the Dominion goes in the Gamma Quadrant. They may well sort of like turn the corner into the fringes of the Delta Quadrant. I was thinking, is it policy to make each quadrant's Jem'Hadar look slightly different for some reason? But I did wonder, why make them different? Why deliberately divide them? And assuming it wasn't just to make them look different for the special effects or whatever, the Founders putting in another stage of obedience conditioning to the Jem'Hadar. Do you have Alphas who have... They've got no reason to genetically program them to be antagonistic towards Gammas. Literally none. Unless keeping them divided against each other is another way of segmenting them and saying they will fight each other rather than rebel against the Founders.
And if any faction does rebel, you can send the other one in, you know?
Exactly.
And it may be the Gamma Quadrant is huge, and I don't know how big the Dominion is supposed to be. We only see like a tip of it, basically. But if it is really big, there may be garrisons of Jem'Hadar on different planets that are specifically adapted to that planet, whether it's, you know, how to breathe the air or, you know, they may look different. We don't know. And this would be an interesting thing to find out in books or whatever. We haven't spoken really about the gladiatorial element. You know, like, obviously that Jem'Hadar in By Inferno's Light is having gladiatorial combat. You know, when they say, I am such a rank and such a name, and I am dead. As of this moment, we are all dead. We go into battle to reclaim our lives. There is something to the gladiator morituri.
We are about to die.
We are about to die, yeah. If they believe that when they go into battle, like their lives are already sacrificed. They're already dead.
It codifies the response of, everyone says, oh, the Jem'Hadar, they're these super elite soldiers. But they're not. They're not super elite soldiers. There's lots of them, and they're willing to do anything, and they're willing to die. So they're not elite soldiers. They are suicide troops. So everyone's fear of them isn't because they're amazing fighters, although they are, obviously, we've seen they are pretty good in certain circumstances. It's because they're willing to absolutely run towards you naked with a knife, even if you've got a machine gun. And even if you shoot them to bits, they will still kill you because they will charge. Because they start off saying these are the cream of the crop, the best troops in the universe. And then actually, if you look at it properly, it turns out they're not that good because they don't last that long. but they are absolutely willing to die. They'll jump on a landmine so that, you know, a changeling could step across their body and get to the other side, sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
That's where the fear is.
Because you've got shows where, you know, when you see your heroes from the show fighting them hand to hand and surviving. So they can't be that great. You know, there is an episode apparently where the studio made them cut out. It was filmed, I guess. Sisko, Dax, and Worf, I think it's them, kill like 40 of them on screen.
Oh, that was to the death.
Yeah, to the death. So, you know, so you've got to.
Yeah,
they're not that great. If our human heroes or humanish heroes, Klingon, okay, but, you know, can sort of fight them hand to hand, survive, kill them, and quickly too, you know, get through them, then they can't be those elite. But it is the thing where they're ants, basically, you know, just like throw as many of them at the enemy until that enemy's end. And it means that they can use their ships and just crash into your ships. They don't care. They're kamikaze.
Which they do in the first appearance, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. So it's they are dangerous. They should be fearsome. I agree. They should be fearsome. Are they elite commandos? Are they like Dahar masters? No, no. All of this is the portrait of these guys. That brings us to really the philosophical ramifications of this. Jem'Hadar, free will. Obviously, slavery is a great evil. But what if the Jem'Hadar were freed to do what they want? That is a question.
That is a huge question.
Wouldn't they be more dangerous to everyone if they were freed? And that's because they were put in this position. They were manipulated into becoming these killers. You know, at the same time, don't you want to be Gornagar and Spartacus, you know?
So there is an inherent contradiction in the philosophy of the Jem'Hadar. Before I go on to that, very quickly, we've got to remember that obedience brings victory and victory is life. They did not develop that. That was clearly given to them. That is not something they've developed. And the reason why I'm sure of that is because of something that another Jem'Hadar, whose name I cannot remember or pronounce, says. The basic premise, victory is life. I go into battle to reclaim my life. Yeah, that's the basic gist of their philosophy. Then we go on to Rocks and Shoals, and this kind of gets exploded because there's a brief dialogue between the Third and Sisko. He does not have to earn my loyalty, Captain. He has had it from the moment I was conceived. I am a Jem'Hadar. He is Vorta. It is the order of things. And this was a Jem'Hadar that very clearly hated the Vorta. Okay, and that Vorta was brilliantly cast because the actor was so good at making you hate him. Sisko then says, do you really want to give up your life for the order of things? And he responds, and this is the critical bit, it is not my life to give up, Captain, and it never was. Okay, so the Jem'Hadar, before they go into battle, and when they get, you know, juiced up on the Ketch So White, obedience brings victory and victory is life. And that life does not even belong to them. Their entire life cycle is one of combat. And this is me giving the writers a lot of credit here, I think, but I suspect that the Jem'Hadar intellect is genetically tamped down. Because if a Jem'Hadar was able to truly, genuinely think about their lot in life, there's a very good chance they'd either kill themselves or kill everyone or go mad, one or all of the three. Because there is literally nothing for them to aspire to except getting killed very early on. And they're also programmed to enjoy and love combat. So it's like they're a suicide machine. They literally are born, they're hyper-aggressive, they're addicted to a drug, so they can't really rebel that well. They're told these beings that you'll never see, almost certainly, created you, and you must live and die for them. And they get at most 13 years, and they are programmed to charge towards death. Put yourself in their shoes for a moment, as much as you can. Imagine what would go through your brain if you stopped for a second to think about that. Okay, imagine if you were a Jem'Hadar who was just occupying a planet. You were just a battalion or a garrison or whatever on a planet that had been conquered, and you're not doing a lot of fighting every day, and you stop and think, I'm not doing the one thing I love. The one thing I love will get me killed, and I'm programmed to do this, and that's it. From the moment you're born, you've got a few years to look forward to, and odds are you're going to get killed in a horrible way in a fight that you have no say in, commanded by a god you've never met. And if you don't get this drug from this person you almost certainly hate every so often, you die in pain. And you can't fulfill your destiny.
Is that so different from a sort of medieval conception of life? You know, you could imagine a crusader having the same, you're not going to meet God unless you believe that if you die, then you will. The Jem'Hadar don't even have that. The promise is Ketra Sol White, I guess, but they don't have the promise of some sort of afterlife, rejoining with the founders or anything like that. So it really is pointless, you know, if they weren't genetically conditioned, they really would have nothing to look for. Because the way, I mean, what we were shown is that they have been programmed. They have been conditioned first genetically and then chemically to obey and to accept this lot in life.
But the cruel twist is that we've seen at least one Jem'Hadar have this cognition and realize and think, I never see my gods. I don't need this drug. And he was trying to save his troops, which means that somewhere in the Jem'Hadar genetic matrix, they haven't eliminated a form of compassion. It's a militaristic one, granted. These were people he was fighting with, alongside rather, but it's still there. So it could develop. There's enough. Remember I was saying earlier about junk DNA? I think, like I said, the founders did not eliminate everything from the Jem'Hadar that was not essential to them as killing machines. The fact that we had that episode Hippocratic Oath shows that they can evolve. They can evolve codes of honor. They can evolve compassion for their fellow soldiers, which makes it even crueler because there is this chance that, like you said, they could be liberated on some level. Going back to By Inferno's Light, the prisoner of war camp, the funny thing is, and I should have mentioned this earlier, you can't take the Jem'Hadar as prisoners. They don't even have the freedom. Now, obviously, it's programmed so they can't surrender, but you could still capture them. But you can't even do that with Jem'Hadar, because if you capture them, unless you've got a supply of Ketracel White, they die. So even that backhanded freedom of incarceration by, you know, in this case, a benevolent enemy, is taken from them. They literally have no options unless they turn out to be a mutant who can produce Ketracel White.
Yeah, they can't be freed. We don't know what happens canonically after the events of Deep Space Nine. You know, there are books. Deep Space Nine Phase 2, which is a series of books that show that Odo sends a Jem'Hadar to the station to integrate and learn what the people of the Alpha Quadrant have to offer in a non-war capacity. I read a couple of those books, but I didn't get to the end at all. So I don't really know. I didn't care to spoil myself by checking. But still, it means that once Odo is part of the Founders, things are going to change. You know, the war ends, but also, will Odo be able to stomach that they have slave races? I would say no. So what happens to the Jem'Hadar from then on? Do they die out in the absence of war? Are they gifted with some sort of freedom from Ketracel White, from this blind obedience? But if they are, and everything they are is violence, it doesn't seem to be a good solution either, you know? So how do you navigate what I think is the sentient need for or right to freedom when these creatures have already been corrupted to the point where you could not trust them with freedom is, I guess, maybe the moral dilemma that Odo will face.
Well, it's true. The funny thing is, in Hippocratic Oath, we also get a kind of interesting counter-argument, kind of a dodgy one from O'Brien when he says, stop being so naive, Julian, and look at them for what they are. I found it quite uncomfortable because it's racial essentialism, because he's saying they're killers and that's all they know how to do and that's all they want to do. Okay, essentialism is just the view that objects, or in this instance, a species, has a set of attributes that are necessary to their identity. It kind of comes from Plato's theory of the forms, where there's a perfect...
Right.
There's a realm of the forms where there's a perfect chair, a perfect this, right, a perfect that. And in this instance, the racial essentialism is that the Jem'Hadar are killers. That's a fundamental part of who they are. I personally disagree with that. I get that they're genetically predisposed and they've been tinkered with. There are two ways of giving the Jem'Hadar their freedom. There's teaching them how to make Ketracel White, making sure they've got their own supply of it, and they can go off and do what they want because they won't die as a species. Or... in the treaty, bizarrely enough, the treaty at the end of Deep Space Nine does actually talk about various things, and there's a canon document online that you can look up. But at no point, and I found this quite strange, but at no point do they mention Jem'Hadar freedom. The only other way you could give them their freedom, and both are risky, obviously, because if you do make the decision that Jem'Hadar, you know, is going to Jem'Hadar no matter what, they're going to just kill. They're aggressive and they're just going to fight. The only other way is genetically alter them. Have them submit as a species to genetic alteration that gives them back that isogenic enzyme so they aren't reliant on the drug. And you say to the Dominion, okay, look, we can't tell you what to do in the Gamma Quadrant perhaps, but in the Alpha Quadrant, if you make any more Jem'Hadar, they have to be able to live without the drug. And you have to decide, are they just killing machines because they've been programmed that way? Or if they're given the freedom to be something else, will enough of them embrace it? Because remember, we are looking at potentially, in the Alpha Quadrant, at the end of Deep Space Nine, Jem'Hadar in peacetime. Now, in the Dominion, it seems, other than the expansion, that the Jem'Hadar can't be fighting all the time because people, as far as I'm speculating somewhat, but the Dominion does not look like it's falling apart at the seams, which means there's not that much internal conflict, which means there may not be that much for the Jem'Hadar to do in the Gamma Quadrant. So there must be a peacetime Jem'Hadar behavioral pattern, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And this gets onto a bit of sort of ancient Greek philosophy. Aristotle thought that slavery was a natural thing and that human beings come in two types, slaves and non-slaves. So some should rule and others should be, you know, marked out for subservience. And so there are natural slaves, and not only that they should be slaves, but they should be slaves under all circumstances. They should not be the option. They are property. And so the Dominion is kind of run by Aristotelian ethics in this instance, because Vorta and Jem'Hadar are natural slaves. Here's the interesting thing, and I think this kind of applies in a way that from the founder's point of view, not mine, I hasten to add. Aristotle said that the reason why they were slaves is because their souls weren't complete. They lacked certain qualities, such as the ability to think properly. And so it wasn't cruel to have them as slaves. They literally needed masters to tell them what to do.
Which is the lie perpetrated by any slave-owning culture over the over the centuries. You know, but in this case, the difference, the science fiction difference, is that it may be true in the sense that the Dominion has gone in there and removed things from these people that made them free people, you know? So
now, it's interesting you say that, because it looks very much like the Jem'Hadar have had certain things removed, but the Vorta, I feel like they've had more stuff added.
Something's been withheld in any, because they are just the same. They are fanatically loyal. And doesn't it happen? There's a Weyoun that is, you know, like a bad batch.
Well, he thinks that they're making a mistake in the way they're applying their philosophy, not that. Because at no point does he say the founders are idiots or they're wrong or...
Or they're not my gods, yeah.
Yeah, he says they shouldn't be doing it the way they're doing it. It's going to hurt them.
But still, it's just like that Jem'Hadar in By Inferno's Light. They're not actually rebelling. But that one act of disagreement with the gods is atypical and a reason to destroy that particular sample. It also happens with the Vorta. So you have to wonder, like, these are two instances that we see, and we don't see the whole culture. So again, why all these controls on the Jem'Hadar specifically?
It's true.
You know, how often does this happen? How many bad batches are there? How many clones are imperfect and have thoughts that are not, you know, acceptable to the founders? Probably, you know, a statistically significant portion. So it's in them, but only as a mutation, a reversion. Maybe it's a gene that sometimes comes up, but has been suppressed. So if you were to free both these people, and we don't know of any other, except maybe the Tosk, you know, maybe the Dominion have a lot of other creatures out there, but these are the two that we know. If they were freed from their genetic conditioning by another genetic modification, and then further either modification or lack of the original modifications to the new batches that were created, including females or non-sterile individuals. In the case of the Vorta, I don't know if the Vorta, I don't think the Vorta are all clones, so I'm guessing they do not procreate normally either. Say you fix
them. Although weirdly, they do have male and female.
Yes, but are they all sterile? Have we ever seen a Vorta romance? It's just because they're supposed to be the spokespeople for the Dominion. So sometimes you want a female or a male, depending on the culture that you're addressing. True, what will they respond to? So that makes sense, you know, in their scheme, and then still make them sterile, still make them asexual. So say you reestablish all that. And the Vorta could be, you know, they could found their own society because they are sort of cultivated. But for the Jem'Hadar, I think I would restore them to an environment. Like, these are not people who would have figured out at their stage of development and their aggression. I don't think they would have figured out spaceships. Not until they're ready, right? So you put them on a planet that is good for them, you know, like the right environment, absent all these modifications, and you let them live their lives without being spacefarers, you know, without going to war with other, you know, like warp-capable cultures. And eventually, maybe they never change. Maybe they become like Klingons. And the Klingons are still, you know, they're warriors as well, but they know how to have fun and they have a culture, and it's not, and they can be reasoned with. They're not all about waging war. Maybe they become that, or something like that. I think freedom for the Jem'Hadar means a reset. They've been robbed of their normal evolution.
Here's a question for you. Okay. Just if you had to be one of these two species, which would you rather be, a Vorta or a Jem'Hadar?
I'd rather be a Vorta.
Tell me why.
Well, in both cases, I'm a fanatic and I believe in these shapeshifters or gods and I'm doing their bidding and whatnot. But on the other, I feel like the Vorta have a more, I mean, it's still fake, but they have more culture. They have more room for advancement for different kinds of assignments. There's more variety to what they're doing than the Jem'Hadar. You know, I'm doing the furthest thing from a soldier that you could imagine, probably. Obviously, the military aspect doesn't interest me. The Jem'Hadar aren't even ambitious in any kind of way. You become first or second, third, because the guy in front of you died. Once you're first, man, a couple years, you're dead. So it doesn't seem like the Vorta, when they die, the next clone has the memory implants of the one from before. So there's a sort of immortality there. It's not the same, but it's kind of the same. So yeah, Vorta's better. I mean, that's my answer. So what's your response?
The key difference for me, looking at this from like you said, the philosophical point of view, is the Vorta seem happy in their jobs. The Vorta smile. The Vorta seem to genuinely enjoy the sort of cut and thrust of debate and of negotiating. They never seem to have any kind of existential doubts. Even the one that quote unquote rebelled wasn't rebelling against his gods. He still had absolute faith and asked Odo, his god, one of his gods, to bless him. They have achieved, now I know it's genetically engineered and you can argue it's false, but you could argue that about anyone who believes in any god, but they seem to have achieved a weird kind of inner peace. They have genetically engineered or evolved, I don't know which, probably genetically engineered, a sense of completion. They get up every day, they do their job for their gods, who they love, who they are sure love them back. Even when Wayun was being told off by a founder, he looked desperately disappointed and sad, but then he got on with his job. They don't seem to have existential crises, you see, and there's an innate core of peace that the Vorta seem to have that the Jem'Hadar never seem to have remotely.
On the other hand, am I saying, by saying, oh, Vorta, that's just my comfort speaking. That looks like a more comfortable position. And I'm equating the two species, saying that, you know, if I'm going to be a fanatical slave, then might as well be a Vorta. But when I say I want to be a Vorta, am I choosing absolute slavery over the Jem'Hadar, who are apparently capable of rebellion, who have inside them that revolt? They are not absolute slaves. That's why there are so many controls on them. That's why the founders are actually afraid of them. They are not absolute slaves. So am I choosing absolute slavery or a spark of free will that is inside a Jem'Hadar? Now, the paradox is that the Jem'Hadar, with that free will, has pretty limited options and ideas what to do with those. You know, that's what I'm responding to. It's like, well, I like the options that the Vorta have, but at the same time, maybe I respect the Jem'Hadar a bit more.
There's always the chance. Now, we didn't see any proper rebellious Vorta, so maybe the genetic engineering is more complete. But if you think it through, they can eat normal food. If a Vorta were able to rebel, they could at least rebel properly. They could flee. They could run away and they wouldn't die because of it, because they can eat normal food and drink. They're not addicted to any drugs. So they've got one less slave collar around their necks than the Jem'Hadar have. The Jem'Hadar, the limits of their existence are, how far can I get before my drug runs out?
And I guess the question that's there for us to answer, specifically to the Jem'Hadar, is on the nature of free will. Because if you free them from Ketracel White, from obligations to the Dominion, do they have free will? I mean, we could ask that of anyone, right? The question of, is there free will? And I'm not talking about fate intervening or being a force. It is apparently a force in the Star Trek universe, or else, you know, all those parallel realities wouldn't have exactly the same people aboard the same ships. But I'm not talking about the author's hand, you know. I'm talking about we are the product, or we can be described as the products of our upbringing, of our attitudes, of our biology, our conditioning. You know, just like the Jem'Hadar, you know, if we do something and it's more instinctual than reasoned, perhaps, I guess we don't have free will. We were always going to do that, given who we are. And I think the Jem'Hadar are maybe a symbol of that, because they are so limited in scope from what we know. If you freed them from addiction, freed them from fanaticism, you know, they just go around and kill everybody, including themselves. And that's the way they're presented. Like what O'Brien says, which is very reductive, but it's very O'Brien. We know his attitude towards Cardassians. I mean, he's got a history of this kind of racism.
Well, PTSD, you know.
Yeah, well, it's a learned racism because he's fought these cultures, and so he doesn't know anything else of them. His bias has been confirmed in conflict. So I understand where he comes from. He's kind of unique among the characters that we were supposed to follow in the Star Trek universe, you know, because he's not quite as evolved in that sense. What he describes as the Jem'Hadar, we don't get much more than that either. This is one of the races where Gorenagar, you know, he seems more thoughtful. He's trying to do something. He has an ambition that is positive and not destructive. And he's fairly unique. And whenever we see like a Jem'Hadar like show a little bit more, like a different attitude a little bit, we're left to wonder, is there hope for these guys? But the way they are presented is, even if we gave them free reign, I'm not saying free will, free reign, then they would just act according to a programming, which might as well be biological and cultural rather than imposed by the Dominion. So I think the question of free will, when you take some really extreme individuals like the Jem'Hadar, it starts to make us ask that question.
Okay, take us all the way back to the episode To the Death, because we're talking about rebellion of the Jem'Hadar. In that, the premise is that some quote-unquote rogue Jem'Hadar have stolen some equipment, and they're trying to fix the Iconian gateway, which would allow them to, you know, travel pretty much anywhere in the galaxy, at least.
Right.
Yeah. Who is it who tells us that these Jem'Hadar are going to launch a general insurrection against the Dominion? It's the Vorta. Imagine if we'd ever actually got to talk to any of these rebellious Jem'Hadar, because we never do. We never get to hear their side of it. What if the Jem'Hadar who are trying to fix the gateway just wanted to escape the Dominion? They just wanted freedom. Because we are only told that they are going to launch an insurrection and overthrow the Dominion by a Vorta who's got a vested interest in that. And at no point does Sisko think, let's capture one of these rogue Jem'Hadar and ask them what they're doing.
Yep, totally. Everybody's drunk the Kool-Aid on Deep Space Nine. They all believe from what they've seen and what they've heard, and the hearing of it is not exactly, you know, non-biased. They believe that the Jem'Hadar are not people, that they are genetically engineered weapons. Like, these ones are rogue. In other words, they do have free will of some sort. You know, whatever they're doing, the Dominion wants them destroyed. So this is a troop of Jem'Hadar who have beat the genetic conditioning to loyalty to the Founders. And what else? And how are they surviving?
The Dominion were willing to sacrifice the Iconian gateway, which would have allowed them to conquer probably pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
They were willing to sacrifice that huge leaping technology to stop this one band of Jem'Hadar.
Yeah.
And let's assume they just wanted to get away. That story would have eventually leaked out, I'm sure. And other Jem'Hadar would have heard about it. And that would have been the most insidious rebellion. They would have been the Spartacai of the Jem'Hadar culture.
This is one of the biggest what-if stories in Deep Space Nine. What if we'd learned that, because we don't know, but it just seems very bizarre that Jem'Hadar cannot disobey genetically. These ones do en masse. Not just one guy, a whole troop, a whole batch, and they must be destroyed at all costs. So what were they going to do? Why is the Federation stopping them from doing it? It is a good question. I mean, obviously, it's like, well, now that these guys are rogue, they're going to attack everything and everyone, including the Federation and its allies. That's the way it's sold. But why does the Dominion care if that happens?
Exactly.
Right? They only care if those Jem'Hadar are going to go take revenge on their slave masters. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, they're treated like mad dogs when they never actually behave like mad dogs. Even the loyal one in Rocks and Shoals, the ones that are running out of Ketracel White, who are like in agony. Yes, granted, they say they would eventually go mad and what have you. But think about it. If they were mad dogs, they would, as soon as they started to feel pain and withdrawal, they would have just gone crazy anyway, because that would have been in their nature. They're more stable than we give them credit for.
And so a lot of what we know of the Jem'Hadar, we don't know. We've been told it's Vorta propaganda. So that's a very interesting thing. One of my projects at some point is going through those Deep Space Nine Phase 2 stories and reading a few more of them. Because, like, let's say this is Season 8. Mm-hmm. There is a Jem'Hadar in the cast. So whenever they put an enemy race in the cast, you know that you know all your assumptions are going to be challenged. Whether it's Worf, yep. Whether it's, you know, whoever, that race that we didn't really trust, Garak, or maybe we never trust Garak. But, you know, it's like, once we have an individual, you see that the race is not monolithic, and that there are different attitudes, and we just don't understand that culture because we've only seen it through the filter of, oh, the Enterprise is fighting these guys, you know, three times a year. With the Jem'Hadar, that's kind of been the case. They've always been painted as tools of the Dominion, and the real villains are the Founders. The Jem'Hadar have never gotten like that one individual that you get to see over a longer period. And that's what the books seem to offer. I'm really interested to find out if they are somehow redeemed or evolved through the course of that book series.
What would this be, the fourth slave collar around the Jem'Hadar's neck? What is the natural lifespan of a Jem'Hadar if you don't kill them?
Mm-hmm.
Because they, you know, we don't know what they're like with illnesses, so let's forget illnesses for. But how long would they live? Because possibly, and this would be really cruel, but if you were writing a story about them to explain, you know, the fundamental core of who they are, what if they're like replicants in Blade Runner and they only live till about, let's be generous and say 20. Even if they did rebel, they'd have to rebel very quickly, you know? I mean,
quickly, and it wouldn't last long, or they'd have to replenish their forces in some way, whether they take over a cloning center, whether they're just freeing other Jem'Hadar. How would you sustain a culture in any way with those limits? It's not obvious, and I'm sure they've got an incept date, because their force grown in 3 days. So already their whole childhood, all those years that a normal individual would be developing from childhood to adolescence to adulthood, are gone. That's like 3 days is your first 20 years. Gone.
Exactly.
And then whatever's left. So even if they didn't have a lifestyle that was lethal, maybe they're supposed to run down quickly. So again, if you were to free them and you were going to do it genetically by reverting their genetics to something that was proper from the beginning, you would have to fix that as well. You know, obviously they would not be force grown. They would not be, at least we can hope. So I think what we've come around to is that Jem'Hadar are not quite as we're told they are. And they may have more free will and more sentience and more options than is pictured. This conversation has changed my conception of the Jem'Hadar, certainly.
Let's go through the checklist quickly of what we've established you would need to do to free the Jem'Hadar, because it's quite a lot.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot to enslave them in the first place.
Right, so one, genetically engineer them, or re-genetically engineer them so that they can produce Ketchusel White organically, or teach them how to make it themselves if you can't do that. You'd also need to kind of reintroduce and re-teach them how to procreate if you could either start making female Jem'Hadar or find the Jem'Hadar original biological template and see if they're still compatible.
Or possibly they might have the two sexes in the same... We don't want to impose...
Oh, no, they might be asexual, yeah.
Yeah, we don't want to impose a sort of mammalian...
That's true. It's just they're referred to as male, but yeah, you're absolutely right. They may well be. You'd need to find them a homeworld, potentially, as well. Anything else? I'm sure there's probably something else that I'm just forgetting.
Deprogramming them.
Yeah, you'd need to teach them something other than killing, because we never see a Jem'Hadar scientist, doctor.
Nothing.
Oh, you wouldn't see a lawyer, but nothing other than soldiers. And I know this is a budget thing, but I just want to mention this. I know you got the Jem'Hadar first, and we're supposed to assume they're the highest rank. Because of budgetary constraints, you never see a Jem'Hadar be in charge of anything more than like a squad or about 20 soldiers. So you never see, like, is there an Jem'Hadar rank of like first plus one or zero or something even higher that commands entire armies?
So they put a Vorta there.
I suppose they would.
Yeah, I see the Vortas as officers.
Yeah.
And because they obey those guys, and those guys are in sort of strategy and all of that stuff. So the Vorta are the officers. So they would need to have more options in their society.
Career opportunities.
Oh, yes.
You'd need a guidance counselor for the entire species.
It's not an obvious liberation, but...
I was going to say, now think about how hard it would be to rehab the Vorta. And that's probably another episode, but just that might be even tougher.
Final thoughts here?
I would just like to finish on a quote from Homer, if I may, if that's not too pretentious.
No! Not that one. Okay.
Not that one. Oh, I wish I could think of a good Homer Simpson quote now to sum up the Jem'Hadar, but I'm not sure he's ever said anything that covers it. But okay, so Homer believed, slightly differently to Aristotle, he said that even if a person wasn't inferior before they sort of become a slave or turn into a slave, enslaving them changes them in such a way that they get ground down and become a natural slave. And he said, Jove takes half the goodness out of a man when he makes a slave of him. And I feel like if our theory is correct that the Jem'Hadar were a species before they were altered by the Founders, that's what happened. The Founders are Jove. Jove takes half the goodness out of a Jem'Hadar when he makes a slave of them.
Yeah. Well, if you can't have the pursuit of happiness, or it's so limited, then you are creating a cruel, violent, negative, destructive person, or in this case, species, I guess is the way to paraphrase that.
When your one joy kills you and you don't even get to choose it or decide it for yourself, that's pretty bleak.
Yeah. Deep Space Nine, the bleakest.
Bleak Space Nine.
Bleak Space Nine. Tell people, Ryan, where they can find you on the internets and other podcasts you're working on.
On Twitter, at RyanBlake235, spelled as it sounds. And my podcast, Wibbly Wobbly Dicey YC, which is a Doctor Who RPG podcast. Season 2 is coming very soon. And that's at WWDWpod. Thank you very much.
There you go. So thanks again, Ryan. Victory is life. And as the loser, I'll stick around for Subspace Transmissions. That's your feedback on our previous episode. Who's editing? A thought experiment in which Siskoid and his guest appoint themselves editors of a comic book line at DC Comics. But the joke's on them, because they can only use the characters of a specific issue of Who's Who, and in fact must use them. Great ideas? Yes, we think so. Cool reinventions? Of course. Crisis fatigue? We guarantee it. Who's Editing? Now on its own feed, only at the Fire and Water Podcast Network, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Révolution, est connu, révélation. Doing this on a rush this month, let me just get into it with a single comment from Chris Franklin. This is about Give Me That Robin Hood, our previous episode, where myself and Alan W. Wright talked about Cupid, and in particular, Picard as Robin Hood, and all things Robin Hood in this episode. So it's Chris Franklin who says, I haven't seen this episode in a long time, but I recall thinking visually it was fun, but the episode itself didn't measure up. I think the real problem is Picard was in total stick-in-the-mud mode in this story, as you two pointed out. Let's face it, Will Riker is much more the classic Robin Hood type, despite the height. This would also be tailor-made for Kirk, but not Jean-Luc, especially one who gets fussy every time Q shows up. I had no idea that Patrick Stewart was dating the actress who played Vash. That explains a lot, because I honestly really never got the appeal of the character either. She works as Julie Newmar's Catwoman to Picard's Adam West Batman in some regards, but oddly enough, the chemistry seems a bit forced. Maybe that's why they didn't stay together? Still, I enjoyed the Robin Hood discussion. Alan W. Wright always brings the goods in that department. Yes, that is very true. To respond to your comments, Chris, the captain who is a stick in the mud during a comedy episode actually harks back to Kirk, because that's my main problem, actually, with The Trouble with Tribbles. Kirk is just so annoyed throughout that I feel like he's not really giving in to the levity of the episode. So I much rather watch the other characters. Kirk is a real drain on the episode. I don't think it's very funny to just have the annoyed character. As for Patrick Stewart's relationship with Jennifer Hetrick, just because we don't see the chemistry on screen doesn't mean they didn't have chemistry personally. I think it's more a question that the two characters don't have chemistry. I don't see these characters and performances really meshing. I'm not into gossip, celebrity gossip, or otherwise. So I'm not going to go look for that. But, you know, Google away. The Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page at patreon.com/FWpodcast. If you like this content and want more like it, think about leaving a one-time or monthly donation. It even unlocks rewards. For example, for $5 a month, you could sponsor this show. And Doug Van Diver has done just that. He's on the Starfleet Commendations list. Join Doug and I in the fleet at patreon.com. As usual, let me remind you that you too can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com, on the Fire and Water Facebook page, and on Twitter, where we are FWpodcast. So, until the next episode, this is Siskoid reminding you to go boldly.